just one more night and make a new plan in the morning? The next day, knowing I didn't have enough money to rent an apartment or stay in a hotel, I found a room in an SRO by the Midtown Tunnel. Shared toilets, shared showers, a small dark room with only a bed and a sink, where I lived for the next week. It was a gloomy, scary place. When I told my agent about my new living situation, she told me she feared for my life. The next day, she found me a sublet in the West Village, whose owner, another model, was working in Paris for the next few months. Vida still didn't have a name. The Brazilian word for life is vida. And I kept hugging and kissing her while saying, "Minha vida, minha vida, my life, my life." So she became Vida. It was the perfect name for her too, because Vida did become my life. Then, a few days after I moved into my sublet, the phone rang. It was my mother and she sounded furious. My credit card was linked to hers, and the credit card bill had just come in the mail. At the time, I was getting some good exposure as a model and building my portfolio, but I wasn't making much money yet. When I did shows or appeared in magazines, I would usually walk away with around $100. I had a little money I'd socked away from working in Japan, and my agency gave me advances they deducted from whatever jobs I got. But my mom and I still shared a joint account, since she felt I was too young to be completely in charge of my own finances. That's how she learned I'd just spent $3,000 at a store called American Kennel. And, Gizi, do you know how much money that is? And what in heaven's name are you thinking? I felt my whole stomach cramp up. I hadn't noticed that extra zero. If I thought $300 was a lot of money, $3,000 was unimaginable. I could still hear my mom's voice. She worked as a bank teller and knew the value of a dollar. But she had to understand. Whether it was $300 or $3,000, buying Vida was the best thing I'd ever done. "Mom," I kept saying, "you don't understand. We're talking about Vida." Let me say it again. Everything I accomplished in my career or life wouldn't have been possible without Vida. Vida was there for me always. She was the only constant in my life. Every day she made me happier, more joyful, and more complete. She was my angel, my shield, my bodyguard, my baby, my daughter, my mother, my closest friend. With Vida around, I was never alone. I could just be an 18-year-old girl. When the model whose apartment I sublet returned home from Paris, I went on and sublet another one, this time on 58th and 8th Avenue. I found it through an ad in the paper. This apartment cost $600 a month, which was all I could afford at the time. It was a cramped studio, the kitchen two black burners and a mini fridge, the bathroom shower a hose sticking down from the ceiling. Prostitutes gathered outside every night at the end of the block. I slept on a mattress on the floor, with Vida next to me. One night I saw something moving around slowly and called out, "Vida?" But I could feel her body next to mine, and when I turned on the light, I saw a rat three times Vida's size crawling around right near me. The next morning, I bought mouse traps at the supermarket. Not only was my mother scheduled to visit me soon, but people told me that rats could eat someone as small as Vida. Vida cried a lot when she was little, so I decided to take her with me wherever I went. I had a small bag, a combination carry-all and purse. When I picked up the bag, she was all ready to go. Vida would leap into it, stick out her little head, and the two of us were off and running. She was completely without fear. I think she thought she was part flying squirrel. Even if I was walking past her casually with my bag open, I'd hear a whoosh sound, like wings beating, and suddenly my bag would be 4 pounds heavier. Soon, Vida was a familiar sight at studios and runway shows. Everyone knew Vida was my dog. She sat in my lap when I got my hair and makeup done. During runway shows, she either stayed in her bag, or I put her on a leash, since otherwise she would have gone racing down the runway after me. Vida was extremely social. She liked making the rounds and making new friends. Knowing how much distance she covered, people began using her as a messenger. Vida would show up with a yellow sticky note on her collar. "Hey, Giselle, I just gave Vida some bacon." Or, "Hey, Giselle, could you please meet me in Studio 6? One time, Vida showed up backstage wearing hair extensions, and another time, my dear friend, the photographer Steven Meisel, took a Polaroid of her with the legend Vogue in the background so Vida could make her CoverGirl debut. More than once, I spotted her in my dressing room with half a bagel hanging from her mouth. After she began swelling up like a balloon, I had to beg people not to give her treats. If for some reason I couldn't bring Vida with me to work, she was always there at home to greet me excitedly and jump onto my lap. Every night she slept beside me on my bed or on my pillow with her little face right next to mine. At night, I felt the fast beat of her heart. It was as if the two of us were connected by an invisible cord. She was as much a part of me as I was of her. When I wasn't working or sleeping, I was on an airplane going to the next job. No matter where I went, Europe, the Far East, Vida came with me. She was a very good traveler, too, quiet and well-behaved. Vida was by my side when I first met Tom, when Jack was young, and when Benny was born. When I moved to Boston, Vida immediately made it clear that she was the queen of the house and our family's chief guard dog and protector. When Benny was little, if anyone dared to enter his room when he was sleeping, Vida would snarl. Tom loved Vida, too. She was no longer a puppy by then, and whenever I had to take 1 or 2 day trips, Tom took her with him to Gillette Stadium so she wouldn't have to be by herself all day. Believe me, he loved it. He told me once that Vida used to chase Randy Moss, the Patriots' wide receiver, around the locker room, and that Randy was scared of her. As time went on, Vida's body began to weaken. Breeds like hers are especially vulnerable to fallen tracheas. Her windpipe got so narrow that air had a hard time passing through. Our whole family, including Vida, of course, was out in Los Angeles the day she got into trouble. I was just finishing up a short vacation and was scheduled to fly to New York the next day for work. I was spending my last afternoon in the jacuzzi with Jack, who was 5, and Benny, who was 2, when Vida showed up and, in full flying squirrel mode, leapt into the bubbling water with us. I quickly took her out. I expected her to shake herself off or roll in the grass the way she always did when she got wet. But a few minutes later, Ben, who was Tom's assistant at the time and our good friend, came running with Vida in his arms. She was shivering and could barely breathe. I was frantic. I couldn't leave the kids alone, so I asked Ben to please rush and take her to the vet, saying she needed to go to the emergency room right away. When they got to Dr. Lisa's, she immediately sedated Vida. The vet told Ben that Vida was having a harder and harder time breathing because her fallen trachea at this point meant that her windpipe was no bigger than a straw. Vida needed to stay sedated at the vet's for observation. And my heart broke that I had to leave the next morning for New York, where I had a contract to fulfill. I was hoping that this was just a bad dream and that Vida would bounce back. But when the vet called me the next day to tell me Vida was getting worse and might not make it, I excused myself. "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I have to go." And took the next flight back to LA. When I got there, Vida was still heavily sedated. It was the only way she could breathe, and she wasn't moving much. She and I spent the whole day together. In the back lawn of our house, there's a small waterfall area with a fish pond surrounded by trees. It's secluded and peaceful. I wrapped Vida up in a blanket, and she and I sat there until it got dark. I cradled her while she went in and out of her sleep. The last thing I wanted was for her to suffocate or be in any pain. The vet had told me she'd come to my home that evening. When she arrived, Vida was still in my arms, wrapped up tight in her blanket. I placed a small heart-shaped rose quartz crystal inside the folds along with my favorite scarf, which Vida loved to sleep on. I put my mouth very close to her face and said, "Thank you, Vida, for taking such incredible care of me. Now it's my turn to take care of you. You are going to sleep now, and when you wake up, you won't be in your body anymore. Thank you, little Vida. Thank you, thank you, thank you." Dr. Lisa couldn't have been gentler, kinder, or more respectful. My best friend took her last breath in my arms. I couldn't stop crying. I buried her along with a few of my favorite crystals, wrapped around the scarf we both loved. Before I met Vida, dogs had always been a big part of my life. Growing up in Brazil, I had a few mongrel dogs, Xuxa, Susie, Fofo, Preto. And after moving to LA in my early 20s, I went to the South Central Pound, where I rescued Hazel, and I also had Willie and Django. When I first introduced Vida to Tom, Tom told me he wanted a dog too, a big male dog. My guess is that some of his teammates were making fun of him for bringing Vida to practice. Through Pet Finder, we found Lua and her brother. I told Tom I was sorry, but I was not getting two new dogs. I was pregnant, and we already had two dogs in Costa Rica. Tom's sister Nancy offered to take in Lua's brother. Then, a few years later, Tom mentioned that since he was a kid, he'd always wanted a beagle. Within days, a beagle materialized in our front hallway as if by magic. Scooby was 3 years old, and Tom said he was a rescue. He knew if he said the word rescue, I couldn't possibly make a fuss, and I didn't. That's also how I found Pepe and Negrita, two dogs I brought in off the street in Costa Rica, who now live down there full-time. If I find a dog or a cat or any animal abandoned on the street, there's no way I will leave them there to suffer, which is why I had so many dogs and 14 cats as a child. A few weeks later, my friend Sam, who lives in LA, called to tell me that a friend of hers had found a few puppies abandoned in the street, and knowing that the other three puppies had homes, I did take one. Vivi named the new puppy Fluffy, but everyone calls her Fluffers. I've loved every one of my dogs. I love my dogs today. But I've never loved a dog as much as I still love Vida. Today, in our house outside Boston, I keep a small altar where the heart-shaped rose quartz crystal that I tucked inside Vida's blanket at the end of her life still sits. I didn't want to bury it with her. I want to keep a part of her with me always, but I needed to bury her with the scarf we both loved. I told myself it would protect her from the cold earth and keep her cozy and warm. That rose quartz crystal is the one physical reminder I have of our last day together. Vida gave me thousands of joyful memories I will never forget. It may sound crazy to say that one small dog could be a guardian angel, a best friend, a protector, a defender, and a constant source of joy and happiness in my life. But it's true. Vida was the most loving, sweetest, smartest, funniest, most courageous little being I've ever known. Not a day went by when she didn't make me feel special and happy and loved. I know Vida can hear me when I tell her over and over again, "Thank you. Mommy will always love you." Chapter 4. Our thoughts and words are powerful. Use them wisely. One intention I try to carry out every day is to live my life with the greatest possible awareness of myself and everything happening around me. This means being fully present while experiencing the moments of my life as they're happening. I think self-awareness is one of the most important things in life. But of course, it isn't a goal so much as it is an ongoing process. When we're in our teens, many of us believe we know all there is to know about ourselves, and maybe everything else as well. Just ask your parents. But a few years later, when we think back on that adolescent self, it can feel as if we're observing a stranger. Who was that girl anyway? I actually find this experience happens every few years or so. Our self-awareness has the potential to deepen and expand, and the biggest influences in this process are our thoughts, words, and actions. What were the first thoughts that went through your mind when you woke up this morning? Did you feel grateful to be alive? Did you appreciate the warmth of your bed and how good it felt to stretch your muscles after a night's sleep? Did you look forward to the day ahead? Did you focus on all the work you have to do and how you never have free time for yourself and how the world sometimes feels like it's conspiring against you? And is it really raining again? I bring up these examples to point out that positive or negative thoughts shape the quality of our experiences. Our thoughts create our words and our actions. In fact, using words is a kind of action. My understanding of the power of my own thoughts deepened tremendously when I began meditating. The more aware I became of where my thoughts were taking me, the more aware I became of the words and actions that followed. I realized that I sometimes felt at their mercy. Aren't our minds supposed to serve us, not the other way around? If your thoughts are positive, your words will tend to be positive too. If your thoughts are negative, your words have a higher probability of doing harm, even if that was never your intention. Once we say something, we can't take it back. Saying things that are negative and damaging can hurt beyond that particular moment. Your words can become a part of their belief system, part of how they define themselves and you. What could be more dangerous than that? I tell my own children that their words are no different from spells. If love and kindness are behind those words, they become charged with positivity and can have a magical effect. But if their thoughts and words arise from anger or jealousy, they can do a lot of damage. Each one of us is like a hard drive that gets imprinted with data. That data comes from our previous experiences. Was your home loving and peaceful? Were you raised with a good role model of how people should treat one another? Or did your family members raise their voices and slam doors whenever a problem came up? It can be hard to shake free from childhood conditioning. By now you know I have close relationships with my own family members. But my relationships at school were a different story. It was in school that I first learned about the power of thoughts and words. When I was 12 or 13, I was a foot taller than anyone else in my class, male or female, and that included my own twin sister. My classmates continually teased me, making me feel weird and uncomfortable in my own body. I weighed around 100 pounds. I used to wear two pairs of pants to school to make my legs look thicker. To distract from how tall I was, I went around with hunched shoulders, which of course only made my height more noticeable. The last thing I wanted was to be different. I just wanted to feel like I belonged. School is the first time most of us are introduced to the idea of categories. Am I an athlete, an artist, a math whiz, a scientist, a theater person, a cool girl? I wasn't part of the cool group, but I was lucky to be a good volleyball player, which helped me a lot with my confidence and made me feel like I belonged to at least one group. Still, some of my classmates really liked picking on me. They had different nicknames for me. The favorite was Ollie, after olive oil, the tall, skinny character from the cartoon series Popeye. Another was Saracura, which is a local Brazilian bird with tiny eyes and stick-like legs. I was also called Camarão, which means shrimp, since my skin turned bright red whenever I played an intense game of volleyball. I remember once walking into my classroom and seeing a poster that featured a drawing of a skeleton, and underneath it someone had written, "Has anybody seen Ollie?" I felt humiliated. Of course, the way I looked affected my social life, too. At friends' parties, I was rarely asked by boys to slow dance and would stand there feeling left out. Since I didn't know any better, there were times that I took my classmates' words as the truth. I would come home after school and gaze at my own reflection in the mirror. Maybe I am a little strange, I'd think. I didn't have the emotional maturity back then to understand why anyone would want to deliberately hurt another person. After all, my own father told all of us that if we didn't have something good to say about someone, we shouldn't say anything at all. Only later did I understand that the bullies at my school only made fun of the kids who didn't blend in with the crowd. The girl with the red hair, the boy with the freckles, and in my case, the tall, awkward, skinny girl. They must have been unhappy with themselves or with their own lives, or maybe they just liked to tease vulnerable kids to make everyone laugh. Or maybe they were projecting their own hurt and suffering onto me as a way to feel less alone with their own pain. I find it hard to believe that anyone who is happy or loving would ever bully someone else for the sheer joy of inflicting misery on them. Obviously, I haven't forgotten my classmates' words, but I've forgiven them and haven't held on to any resentment or bad feelings. If I'd let those words define me, I would have stopped believing I was good for anything. When I got to São Paulo, I thought that was the end of it, since being tall and skinny now seemed to be a good thing. But then I heard the words of a fashion editor during one of my first castings. "She'll never be on the cover of my magazine. Her eyes are too small, and her nose is way too big for her face." I was so sad, and that day I called my dad to tell him what had happened. He said, "The next time someone tells you that, you tell them. I have a big personality, too." Somehow, hearing my dad's words made me feel much better and gave me renewed confidence. I always remember those words whenever anyone says something mean to me. Yes, I do have a big personality, and that I see as one of my strengths. Still, at 14, I was very much a tomboy, thin, muscular, and healthy, with normal-sized breasts. But then I hit puberty. 2 years later, my breasts got a lot larger, which made me stand out again and feel even more self-conscious, especially during a time in fashion when pale, androgynous-looking models were getting all the jobs. I was close to 5'10", somewhere between 115 and 118 pounds, and very skinny, with massive boobs. They even nicknamed me Boobs from Brazil. At fittings, none of the sample sizes were made for women who were built like me. As a result, I wasn't feeling pretty or worthy. Never good enough. But the negative words that people used to describe me were also motivating. From that point on, whenever I was offered a job, I told myself I had to be more than good. I felt I needed to rise to the occasion every time and earn people's trust. Yet I still felt weird and awkward and could barely believe it when anyone in the business gave me an opportunity and hired me for a job. Becoming a mother has stirred up vivid memories of my childhood. Benny and Vivi are still very young, but I have told them that the words other people use to describe them are only true if they accept them as true. For example, they might want to respond by saying, no, actually you're wrong. This is the truth about me," instead of letting someone else define them. The process of learning to define oneself isn't always easy, especially when you're young and your identity revolves a lot around what other people think and say about you. Still, I emphasize with Benny and Vivi that the choice of self-esteem is theirs, and that most of the time, the words people use to describe us are projections of what they are feeling about themselves. After all, maybe when negative words are directed at us, the other person is just having a bad day and is simply venting his or her frustration. Benny is one of those kids who gets upset if someone steps on an ant. If a kid falls down on the playground, Benny is the first one to rush over to make sure they're all right. Every morning when he arrives at school, Benny gives his friends a hug. But he's gotten his share of teasing, too. Imagine being the son of a famous New England Patriots quarterback and going to school in New England and being someone who'd rather draw, sing, and build with Legos than play sports. My own experience growing up has been good preparation for me to help Benny navigate school and a situation for me to learn compassion for my younger self. Everyone is unique, and in time we start to learn about our natural gifts, what delights and motivates us, as well as what aspects of our personality we need to work on. I explained to Benny that Daddy is very good at throwing a ball, but he only became great at it after years of practice and dedication. Mommy is a warrior for the environment. Jack is a great soccer player. Vivi is a leader with her friends. And you, Benny, are a very good artist and singer. Benny seemed happy to hear that, but I know there will be many more conversations about this topic. In fact, one morning last year when I was making the kids breakfast, out of nowhere, Benny, who was at the table, said, "Mom, what's a celebrity?" It took me a moment. Where had he even heard that word? But finally, I told him, "A celebrity is someone who works at a job that's more visible than other jobs. Doctors, dentists, teachers, farmers, they all do very important work." Daddy, I reminded him, has a very visible job playing for a professional football team whose Sunday games are often televised. "It doesn't mean the person doing that job is more important," I went on. "It just means that what they do is more visible." Benny seemed to accept this. "Oh, okay, Mom." But it made me think about what he might be hearing at school about Tom and me that he doesn't tell us about. Later, I told Tom how important it is to talk to Benny about what Mommy and Daddy do for a living. It was time. So we did. Tom told Benny how hard he works and reminded him that he was one of the last people picked in the NFL draft back in 2000. "It wasn't like I was always good at this," Tom said. "I studied. I practiced, and then I got better and better at it." Benny, know that as an 8-year-old kid, the more you dedicate yourself to something, the better you become at it. In response to the question, Benny didn't ask, but must have wondered, "How do people even know my dad's name?" Tom told him that people know his name and like him because they like what he does or because they love sports, but that doesn't mean they really know him, not the way our family knows him. Think back to the words other people have said to you. Those words had the power to hurt you, inspire you, motivate you, frighten you, comfort you, cheer you, make you doubt yourself, or make you feel understood, appreciated, and loved. Like most people, I've used words both positively and negatively. I've said things in anger and spoken words with love. Most of the time, I try to set a steady emotional tone, but still, I've said things I wish I could take back. I am far from perfect, but the good news is I keep on practicing, and I do learn from my mistakes. Again, what are we all here on Earth for, if not to learn? It's important to remember that whenever you treat yourself unkindly or critically, you are only hurting yourself. Change doesn't come from being judgmental or from putting yourself down. It comes from inspiration, from the desire to want to do better, to try again, to give it your best. When you learned how to walk, did you immediately run or jump onto an escalator? No, you took a single step. Maybe you stumbled and fell. You got up again. Next time you took 2 steps, then 3. That's how we all learned how to walk. That's also how we learn about ourselves and how to navigate life. No doubt my most negative words have been reserved for my family members, especially my sisters. Unfortunately, family members know one another's tender spots and all too often can cause emotional hurt. I remember a fight with Pachi on Skype, although I forget the exact details. It had something to do with me thinking Pachi was being overly controlling or disrespectful. I got really angry. In fact, I was barely aware of what I was saying. The words flew out of my mouth before I could stop them. I began with, "Well then, let me tell you what I think about you." My intention was to hurt Pachi, and I did. After all, hadn't she hurt me first? In the silence that followed, my twin sister was speechless. I was too. I felt regret right away. That was such a cheap shot. The call ended. We both hung up feeling terrible. I couldn't get to sleep that night. I kept thinking what an idiot I was. I love all my sisters. Why had I been so mean? My justification, but Pachi was mean to me first. She started it. Suddenly seemed lame. There were so many other, better ways I could have dealt with the situation, like saying, I'm sorry you feel that way about me, or, why don't we speak again tomorrow? I didn't need to slam my sister, but I had, and I spent the next day or two incredibly upset. How do we apologize to someone we love, whose feelings we've hurt badly? A few days later, when Pachi and I spoke, the first words out of my mouth were, I'm sorry. Pachi thanked me and accepted my apology, but for the next week or so there was a definite strain between us. I knew it was my fault. I hadn't been self-aware enough to set the right tone, and I hadn't acted in a loving or respectful way, which is how I like other people to treat me. There have been situations since then when I've gotten angry, but I've mostly learned to pause and reflect before speaking. Tom and I don't argue much, but sometimes when I feel anger rising in me, growing, I become aware of what's going on. Instead of reacting in a way I'll regret later, I remember to breathe. Then I'll tell Tom it's better if we talk later, and I leave the room. Meditation has been key in helping me with my own reactivity. I think of my anger as a visitor, and I can see that it is potentially destructive, so I make the conscious choice not to engage with it. The next time Tom and I are together, we can revisit whatever we were talking about in a loving, respectful way, and we always do. Sometimes, instead of verbally reacting, I'll write a letter. My dad taught us that whenever we felt confused or unclear about something, we should seek out a quiet space and put our thoughts and feelings on paper. When you are done, he said, read it and you will see things more clearly. Once, when Tom and I were having a rough time, I got an email from him that hurt my feelings. He was in Boston at the time, and I was in Costa Rica. Instead of retaliating by sending a hurtful email back, I took out a pen and a piece of paper, and for the next hour I wrote down my thoughts and emotions, the things that made me angry, the things that made me frustrated, everything I was feeling at that time. I didn't censor myself. It was non-stop, no restrictions. When I finished, I was shocked to see I'd written almost 3 pages. I also felt relief. It's much more helpful to me when I write my thoughts out in longhand. It's between me, my pen, and my paper. Writing by hand also eliminates the danger of impulsively pressing send and then not being able to take my email back. The words in front of me felt honest and intense, crazy intense, actually. Just writing them down made me feel 100 times better. In the end, I never sent the letter. I let a day go by. Then I read what I'd written a few more times. That night, I rolled up the letter and burned it. It was as if by writing the letter, my turmoil had left me and gone into my writing hand, onto the sheet of paper. And then the fire burned it all away. The next morning, I sent Tom a brief email telling him I was only willing to be in a relationship that was based on love and respect, and that I looked forward to us talking whenever he was ready to speak to me in a loving and respectful way. A day later, we did just that. One of the greatest benefits of self-awareness is the access it gives us to our own inner voice. We all have one, even if at times we ignore it or remain totally unaware of its existence. Our inner voice is very private and unique to us. Its purpose, I've always believed, is to protect us, help us stay true to our values, and urge us to do the right thing. I believe each of us has a higher, more evolved self within. Often, if we listen to our inner voice, we come to realize that our higher self already has the answers to our questions. When I was young, my grandmother told my sisters and me that we each had our own star in the sky. How do I tell which star is mine? I asked her. It's the one that shines the brightest to you, said my grandmother. No matter what you call your inner voice or what form it takes, your star, your guardian angel, your creator, your God, your highest self, It is always looking out for you. Your inner voice is always there to remind you that you are not alone. Its goal isn't to ensure we play it safe or never have fun. Sometimes, in fact, it pushes us to take risks. These days, before I make any decision, I check in with my inner voice. It needs to signal to me a quiet, yes, this is the right thing to do, before I move forward. As our self-awareness gets stronger, our inner voice does too. Today, I'm still relatively young and lack the self-awareness I hope I'll develop in the future. Still, I do realize this much. The better we know ourselves, the easier it is to find out what we're good at, what motivates us, and what brings us the greatest joy. As everyone knows, life can have a lot of chapters. A doctor can decide to become a philosopher. A firefighter can choose to become an actor, or the other way around. And a girl who grew up believing she'd play professional volleyball or help sick dogs and cats can become a runway model. Some things do stay the same, though. I still love animals, and on the rare times you find me behind a volleyball net, I'm as intense a player as ever. If my shoulder didn't dislocate every time I played, I would do it more often, but I'm fixing that problem, so pretty soon I'll be back having fun and playing all the sports I love. Once you recognize and appreciate the things you're good at, it becomes much easier to focus on what exactly it is that you want to make happen, and even more important, why. That process begins with paying attention to your inner voice. Though first you need to make sure that voice is really yours, not the voice that tells you you're supposed to do something or act in a certain way, not the voices of your mother or father, not the voices of your teachers, not the voices that trickle down from society, from your peer group, or from any organized belief system, not even your inner critic, the one telling you all your faults. No, your inner voice is the one that more than any other gives you a kind of knowing. I admit that sometimes it seems confusing because a lot of voices can be talking at the same time. One voice might be saying one thing while another says something else. How do you know which voice to follow? My advice is first to become as quiet and still as possible. Then pay attention to what your body is telling you. When you think about what the first voice is saying, do the muscles in your shoulders stiffen? Does your stomach feel funny? Now consider what the second voice is saying. Does your body feel more relaxed and open? Does your breathing get steadier? Listen to your body. Ask yourself, will the voice I follow keep me up at night? Or will I be able to go to sleep feeling good about myself? I follow the inner voice that fills me with peace, lets me sleep well, and makes me feel good about myself the next morning. If the decisions I make are based on love, and the actions I take reflect that love, then I'm being true to my inner voice. But there have been plenty of times when I've ignored that voice and paid the consequences, small and large. For example, I've had wavy hair since I was a child, but when I started modeling, straight hair was the trend in fashion. So a friend took me to get a flat iron that made my hair straight, and I used it every day. I just wanted to fit in and look cool, like all the other girls around me. At 16, when I moved to New York, I was suddenly surrounded by a lot of girls who weren't straightening their hair, and I finally felt it was okay to stop. It was a liberating feeling to let my hair be just what it was. It's so funny that today something I'm known for is my natural hair texture. Another time was when I was 14 and decided to move to São Paulo. I thought I knew myself pretty well. I was a good girl. I had my head screwed on straight. I knew the difference between right and wrong. I wasn't going to fall off the rails. I also felt protected somehow. Someone or something was always looking out for me. I was convinced of it. Before I left home, my parents made it clear that they trusted me. They knew I was responsible and dedicated. I was a strong student, the captain of my volleyball team, and a good helper around the house. They also knew I would never do anything to disappoint them. Plus, a month earlier, my dad had even written a long letter to Elite, my first modeling agency, to tell them he was entrusting them with his daughter. I packed a single suitcase and backpack with everything I owned, and my dad put me on the bus, though not before giving me 50 Brazilian reais for taxi fare once I arrived in São Paulo. 27 hours later, the bus pulled into one of São Paulo's four massive terminals. When I got inside the station, my first response was, "Whoa." There were more people in that one bus station than there were in all of Horizontina. It was overwhelming. I wandered around the terminal for a while, dragging my suitcase, just staring at the people and the signs. My dad had given me strict instructions. When I got to São Paulo, I was to use the reais he'd given me to take a taxi to the model's apartment, immediately. My inner voice couldn't have been clearer or more in agreement that this was the right thing to do. In fact, it was the only thing to do. Find a taxi, go to the model's apartment. Just then, I was aware of another voice. "Gizi, if you're planning on going to castings, you need to wear the right clothes." I didn't own even a single pair of jeans that fit me right. All I had in my suitcase was my school uniform and a few t-shirts and pairs of pants I had inherited from my older sisters. How could I go to castings looking like that? Clothes had never mattered to me. But now, surrounded by well-dressed city people who looked like they knew what they were doing and where they were going, I felt the need to spruce up my appearance. Why did I have to follow my inner voice? As I stood in the middle of the station, I came up with a new plan. If I took the subway to the model's apartment, I could use the money that was left over to buy a few pieces of clothing that actually fit me, and that would actually be mine. In those days, 1995, there were no such thing as cell phones. I couldn't call my dad and go over my new plan with him, and even if I could, I probably wouldn't have. I felt independent and in charge of my own life. I followed the signs for the subway, bought a ticket, and stood on a crowded train car with my suitcase next to me and my backpack hugging my shoulders. São Paulo is an enormous place. It's so big that it can take 3 hours or more to get from one part of the city to another. I asked people for directions, changed lines 3 or 4 times, and by the time I got to the subway station closest to the model's apartment, I felt both incredibly intelligent and incredibly proud of myself. I'd outwitted the voice in my head and found my voice. But when I took the backpack off my shoulders to get my wallet, it was gone. I'd left my backpack shut, but the top now flapped open. My wallet with the money in it hadn't dropped out. Someone had stolen it. As if I was in a dream, I left the subway station and went outside. The streets were hot and smelly. I crouched down on my suitcase and burst into tears. It wasn't just the missing money that upset me, though that was bad enough. It was that now I had no ID either. Thank God I still had the slip of paper with the address and phone number of the model's apartment. But I didn't have any money to make a call at the payphone. A woman passing by saw me crying, and when I told her what had happened, she gave me enough change to call my parents. My dad answered the phone. "Hi, Dad," I said. "It's Gizi." And I started crying again. My dad was furious with me, and who could blame him? I'm sure he must have been incredibly worried, too. I had ignored my inner voice, not to mention my dad's outer voice, and as a result, I'd made a stupid decision. It was a devastating thing to do to my parents. They had trusted me, and I'd let them down. Even if they'd wanted to help, they were 27 hours away. Fortunately, I had enough change left over to call the chaperone at the model's apartment. "I was by the subway," I told her. "Would she mind giving me walking directions?" It took me nearly an hour to get to the apartment. São Paulo in January is sweltering hot, and I dragged my suitcase for 10 very long blocks, red-faced and sweating and feeling like a failure. Though luckily, most of the route on Teodoro Sampaio was downhill. No one seemed to notice I was crying, And I remember how strange that felt, since in Orizonchina, people would have stopped and asked me what was wrong and if they could help. I finally reached the model's apartment, met the chaperone, found my bed, and settled in. From that point on, things got better. Three other girls were living there, and though at 16 and 17 they were slightly older, we all got along. I slept in a bunk bed. The first few nights were scary, since it was the first time I'd slept in a bedroom without my sisters. The modeling agency paid my rent and gave me an advance for my living expenses. The other girls liked me in part because I was always cleaning the apartment. Even back then, I couldn't help myself. I went to a fashion retail store and bought a new pair of jeans and a white t-shirt, which I wore every day and washed on weekends, and it became my new uniform for all my castings. I bought a map and began figuring out the times and locations of my castings. I spent hours analyzing what subway or bus I needed to take to get here or there. Pretty soon, I'd memorized almost every bus and subway line in the city. Within a month, I knew São Paulo cold. Whenever new girls showed up in the model's apartment, I was able to take them under my wing and tell them the best ways to get around. I had ignored my inner voice, the voice that was telling me the right thing to do. And when I didn't listen, I made the wrong decision. I sometimes experience my own inner voice as a feeling. If I'm able to breathe quietly and calmly, then I know it's serving me well. If my breathing is shallow or ragged, it's a good indication something is wrong. When I decided to use the 50 reais my dad had given me to buy myself some new clothes, I thought I was being smart. But I knew it didn't feel right. Not in my head, not in my body. The wisdom of this inner knowing feeling became even clearer 10 years later in 2005 when I was making the decision about whether I should continue working for Victoria's Secret. I was 19 when the company offered me a 5-year modeling contract. When that offer came in, Vogue had just named me Model of the Year. I remember showing up for the ceremony in my hippie shirt, broken Birkenstocks, and usual oversized, ripped, comfy jeans. When Anna Wintour saw me and asked if I had something to wear, I said, yes, this. So right away, she asked Grace Coddington, Vogue's creative director, to find me a better outfit. Though I'll never forget those expressions of shock about what I was wearing. In those days, I was a fashion model, and Victoria's Secret was a catalog company. In 1999, there was a strong division between the two. Either you modeled clothes for Alexander McQueen, Versace, Dolce & Gabbana, and other high-end brands, or you worked commercially. There was no crossover. But when Victoria's Secret told me the terms of the contract, I was so happy. Working with Victoria's Secret would give me financial security for the first time in my life and a steady job for 5 years. I wouldn't have to do 100 shows a year anymore. No more flying to a new city every few days. No more worrying about job offers drying up or about my own financial future. For the first few years, I felt comfortable modeling in lingerie, but as time went on, I felt less and less at ease being photographed walking the runway, wearing just a bikini or a thong. Give me a tail, a cape, wings. Please. Anything to cover me up a little. As time passed, I felt more and more uncomfortable. But I loved the people I worked with there, especially my dear friend turned Cupid, Ed, who had hired me and who many years later set up Tom and me on a blind date. By 2006, thanks to a contract extension, Victoria's Secret and I had been together for 7 years. My work with them still made up 80% of my annual income. The company told me they wanted to extend my contract for another 2 years. To everyone around me, it was a very easy yes. Victoria's Secret and I had had a long, trusting, mutually beneficial relationship. But I couldn't decide whether to stay or go. When you work for a company the size of Victoria's Secret, modeling is only part of your job description. There's also a lot of promotion, store openings and in-store appearances, television and print commercials, coast-to-coast travel, backstage interviews, photo shoots for the catalog, as well as for the website. Whenever Victoria's Secret introduced a new lingerie line, fragrance, or catalog with a special theme, it was my job to help promote it. If the company flew me to a remote beach in Virgin Gorda to model the latest swimwear line, a tabloid TV show would also be on hand to chronicle every step I took. I was certainly grateful for the opportunity and the financial security the company had given me, but I was at a different place in my life, and I wasn't sure I wanted to continue working there. A few months later, I still hadn't made a final decision, and now it was time to make up my mind. Every time I thought about my decision, my stomach got tight. If I renewed my contract, that meant I would keep on having to live my life on the company's terms. There wasn't anything I could do about their vision. Victoria's Secret was a huge corporation, and the train there ran at full speed, and they couldn't change my vision either, and the way I felt. That night before bed, I prayed, "God, please show me the way. Give me a clear sign. Should I leave? Should I stay? What should I do? Was leaving the right thing to do? Should I hold firm to my own beliefs? Was I sabotaging my own career?" The next morning, I was no closer to a decision than I'd been the night before. I meditated for 30 minutes, asking myself the same questions over and over. Every time I did, my stomach felt tight. Looking back, I think I was hoping that someone else would make my decision for me. That someone else, of course, was my inner voice, or my star, or my guardian angel, or God. Today, I tell Benny and Vivi, when you pray, look for your star. Pray every night to your guardian angel. Maybe tomorrow you have a test in school. Well, then ask your guardian angel to protect you. If the angels are messengers of God, talk to them, or go straight to the top and talk to God. I remind Benny and Vivi that they can pray to the sky outside, or inside a church, or in their beds. Anywhere, anytime. I felt guided, and it came to me in a flash. I crumpled up two small pieces of paper and placed them inside an empty teacup. On one paper, I'd written the word yes, which meant I was staying. On the other, I'd written the word no, which meant I was leaving. I closed my eyes and set an intention. Whatever piece of paper I chose would be for my highest and best self and be the right decision. I reached in and picked up the one that read no. This was a confirmation. No was the answer I unconsciously wanted to hear. It was also the answer my body wanted to hear, and I believe had been trying to tell me for days. From that point on, I was at peace. I believed, trusted, and accepted that I'd made the right decision, or at least the best one for me. The tightness in my stomach vanished and didn't return. That same morning, I got on the phone with my agent and the team at Victoria's Secret, and I thanked everyone repeatedly. I was incredibly grateful for all they had done for me during the past 7 years. It had been a great opportunity and an amazing ride, but I wasn't going to renew my contract. Sometimes there's no clear explanation why something feels right, but I believe you still need to follow what your inner voice is telling you. In the end, I was able to use the time and energy I'd spent working and traveling and devote it instead to what would become two of the greatest blessings in my life, my marriage and my children. The more we trust our intuition, the stronger it gets. When I first began meditating, I discovered that I could put aside all my stress and anxiety and find a level of peace I hadn't known before. I still use meditation to get to that place, but I also use it to guide me and show me the way forward whenever I'm confused and need clarity. I find that if I'm patient and give the process enough time and space, the next step always becomes clear. Which is why when anyone asks me for advice, the first thing I say is, get quiet, find your inner voice, and listen to it as carefully as possible. Avoid taking things personally. People will say things to you and about you, but try not to let their words affect you. Other people's words have almost nothing to do with you and almost everything to do with them. Instead, ask yourself, what do I really want? And why? Be as clear as you can about your intentions. Find your inner voice, listen to it, and keep refining the practice. The more you listen to it, the stronger it becomes. Stay true to your inner voice. It will remind you that you are never alone. And I promise it won't ever steer you wrong. Chapter 5. Where your attention goes is what grows. At the end of every year on New Year's Eve, I make two lists that together sum up what I've done over the past 12 months. The first one spells out all the things that made me proud, learning a new skill.